very privileged life. I hid in a laboratory basically for 20 years, and the Wellcome Foundation paid for me to do whatever I felt like. And then I emerged out of that laboratory to teach, which I hadn't done a great deal of, certainly not in the Western world. And I was horrified at the changes that had occurred during the time I had been in my academic monastery, if you like. Basically, the students had been trained in a very different way. Students today are just as intelligent as ever they were, but they are not educated as they used to be. The book that sort of put it together for me was a book called The Closing of the American Mind. Have any of you read it? Yes, good. Two or three. The book was written by Alan Bloom, who was a professor of philosophy, I think, at Chicago when he wrote the book, but he was at Toronto for a long while, and then I think Cornell. A Jew who knew that something had gone wrong with education somewhere since the 1960s. And he wasn't exactly clear as to what had gone wrong. And writing the book was his way of clarifying his mind. I summarize his book by saying that if Bloom is right, the modern student is very close to what could properly be called a barbarian. A barbarian being someone who does not know his own cultural history. Well, I said this in a lecture to medical students. Now, calling medical students ignorant and barbarians is a very good way to create a riot, because they are not used to anything other than affirmation. So at the end of the lecture, I had a group of students, about a third of the class, in fact, milling around and really quite angry with me. And I said, well, we're at least a quasi-scientific faculty. It wasn't me that said it was Bloom. And why don't we do the experiment? And they said, what do you mean? And I said, well, if I understand Bloom right, he says the only way that you can understand your culture is by understanding the book that makes your culture what it is. All great cultures of the world are rooted in a great book. If the great book of our society had been the Quran, this would be a Muslim society and the women would be wearing veils. If the book had been the Vedanta, this would be a Hindu society with all that that means. If it had been Das Kapital, we would be in the chaos that Eastern Europe is in now. If it had been the Old Testament, we would be Jewish. With the combination of the old and new, we are what we are. Bloom understood that clearly. And I said, so he says, if you do not understand, if you do not know the Bible, then you are a barbarian. You do not understand your own cultural history. So let's do an experiment. And the experiment that I proposed off the cuff was, you would all agree that the Sermon on the Mount is great teaching. What could anyone say but yes? I mean, they hadn't read it, but they knew that it was supposed to be good. And I said, now, tell me how it starts. And tell me what it says. Absolutely no knowledge whatsoever. And I said, seems Bloom is correct. Then the great asset of the modern student is that they are much more honest than we used to be. And they said to me, well, what are you going to do about it? And I said, well, it's your problem, not mine. And they said, yes, but you have some education that we haven't. And I said, well, what you actually need is an Agnostics Anonymous group. That just came out immediately. And, of course, the title captured their imagination. So whenever I get the chance, I run Agnostics Anonymous tutorials in Ottawa. And people say, we're off to AA, you know. What I did for them was to introduce them to what the options are. You see, everybody has a belief system, including our liberal elite. They just don't know how to label their belief system, neither do they know its cultural history. And that's been an exceedingly interesting experience for me, but it's not what I'm going to be talking about primarily today. It's essential that we know the cultural background to our society if we are to understand our society. But in the context of medicine, it becomes even more important. And let me illustrate that. I was asked 2 or 3 years ago to speak in Frosh Week to the students, because the year before I'd had in my tutorial group the brightest student in the year, actually, not a Christian, he knew I was a Christian, but he greatly enjoyed the tutorial group and arguing with me. And when I got back from Africa that summer, on my answer phone there was a request that I go and speak in Frosch Week to the students. There were three or four professors were to speak one afternoon, one on the history of medicine, one on medicine today, another on medicine future, and me on the topic of a physician between two cultures, to talk about the African experience. And I was third on the list, and by the time it got to me, I thought the students had been stroked enough. It was time to stimulate them a little bit. So I began by telling them a story, which I use frequently when talking for the CRPP. Absolutely true story. I said that I had seen a child with a septic knee, and the knee was totally destroyed. The only thing we could do was an amputation. We told the parents that, and they said, we need to think about it. We said, well, not more than an hour, this child will not survive. And they thought about it, and within the hour they said, no, we will take her home to die. And I was the only person who was horrified, because this was in Africa. The missionary surgeon who was there had seen it before, and he went about his business. The African nurses clearly thought that this was an honorable decision. So I said to them, do you mind if I talk to you a little bit? And they said, no. So I said, if this had been a little boy, what would you have done? And they said, oh, we'd have done the amputation. And I said, why treat little boys and little girls differently? And they looked at me and they said, well, in our culture, it is a woman's role to till the field, fetch the water, and bear the children. So a woman with one leg cannot do those things. She will not get married, and her life will be not worth living. Does that sound like a phrase that's appearing in our culture now? It should do. You see, cultures are not equal. They all have ideas of honor, of love, of justice, and of truth. But the way that those ideas are expressed varies. Now, your children and your grandchildren, when they go to university, will be taught by anthropologists who will tell them of the differences between cultures and then draw an invalid conclusion. They will say all truth about morality is relative to the culture. Not true. Absolutely not true. But not one in 100 Christian students knows how to argue with a professor. Probably not one in 100 Christian adults knows how to argue with the professor either. Because we have long since in our churches given up the habit of proper teaching, which is rigorous. You see, all cultures, in fact, have some things in common. The idea of truth and falsehood is common to all cultures. The idea of love and hatred is common to all cultures. Justice and injustice, honor and dishonor. But those are very big ideas. We can't handle them easily. So they have to be translated into practice by what Peter Crave calls value opinions. And they vary. For example, if your business went bankrupt in Britain or Canada 100 years ago, the honorable thing to do was to wind up as efficiently as possible and pay as many debts as possible. If your business went bankrupt in Japan, the honorable thing to do was commit suicide. In Canada today, the honorable thing to do is to employ a lawyer to pay as few debts as possible. The idea of honor still exists, but it has changed in Canada, and it is different between societies. But the fundamental idea is common. It is honorable, if you are a Tutsi, to shoot a Hutu without compunction, and vice versa. Cultures differ, and we need to recognize that. I went on to say to the students that if they call themselves multiculturalists, which all students do, they have a problem, because as multiculturalists, they have to accept that idea of the value of a little girl and a little boy as equally valid with our own, which I trust was that little boys and little girls were equally valuable. They could not have their cake and eat it. And you could see the anger that I had produced by hanging them out to dry. And I said, what is more, the problem that you face is not going to be dealt with in this medical program, nor in any other medical program in Canada, because you are going to be taught medicine on a biopsychosocial model. And as far as I was concerned, that model had been weighed in the balances and found wanting, and I could prove that assertion by hazarding a guess that no more than one of them could tell me what I had just said. Because in order to tell me what I have just said, you must not be a barbarian. You must know your own cultural history. The phrase weighed in the balances and found wanting must import into your mind a whole story. Now, I'm not going to embarrass you by asking how many of you know what the story is. I'll tell you. It's Belshazzar's feast. Belshazzar had profaned the sacred vessels of the Jews in an orgy. And in the middle, a hand started to write on the wall, "Many, many tekel euphasin." Everybody naturally was terrified. Didn't know what to do. So they sent for Daniel, who naturally was not there. When he came, he said, "Be it known unto you, O King Belshazzar, that the words mean that you and your kingdom have been weighed in the balances and found wanting, and you will be dead and your kingdom will be gone in the morning." See, the students thought I was saying the biopsychosocial model was a few grams underweight. They were bright, they could fix that themselves. I wasn't saying that. I was saying the biopsychosocial model of medicine is profanely and profoundly wrong and should be trashed, because it presumes to teach medicine as though we are not spiritual beings, which is a lie. The model that is being proposed can no more deal with the issues of death, of suffering, of injustice, than it can fly. It is incapable. All that psychology can do is manipulate those things to make you feel as though they are not important. Cannot deal with them in any intellectually or spiritually satisfying manner. It was very interesting. At the end of that afternoon, again, I had a large number of students who had a lot of questions to ask, because I had touched a defect in their education, which was very real. Now I want to switch to make my next point to Africa. Because I'm going to bring this home to you and to what CRPP has to do in Canada and what we need your help to accomplish. But I think I can make the point in a way that you will remember by going to Africa. We have had a program running in Eastern Zaire since 1987, because my academic interest has been the resuscitation of malnourished children. And I've been deeply intrigued, bothered, troubled by the fact that we cannot do nutrition education in sub-Saharan Africa. It does not work. Anyway, in 1994, when the Rwandan war blew up, we were there. My wife was on the board of World Relief Canada, so she went to Goma to see what was happening, and was there when 80,000 people died in a week. She was in Rwanda on the wrong side of the border when they closed the border to Zaire. When we both got back in October, she having been in the thick of it, I having been on the edge of it, Sally could not get the plight of the children out of her mind, because there were 5-year-olds being looked after by 7-year-olds. Coming out of Rwanda, there were children by the side of the road crying every 500 meters, having lost their parents. There's not a family in the refugee camps that hasn't had 2 or 3 people killed. That's another story. Anyway, it was quite clear that Sally had to go back. So she spent, I would guess, I haven't worked it out, something like 2 of the last 3 years in Africa. And I've been there for about 6 months. But she ended up running programs in the refugee camps, not specifically for the children, because there were more fundamental things to be done first. And so in the summer of 1995, I went out to visit. Now, my research could not be done because the whole area was in chaos, and I thought I would spend the summer preparing some talks and lectures for the fall. But my wife had other ideas. She said, "Absolutely not. You must talk to the people in the camps." And I said, "What on earth can a professor from Canada have to say to people living under tarpaulins?" And she said, "They won't listen to the people from the peace and reconciliation programs, but they will listen to you, because we're known. And you have different things to say to them." Often wives, well, my wife anyway, is the one who pushes me to do things that I would otherwise not do. I would live in a library quite happily, and she makes it quite clear that that is not appropriate. Anyway, 3 days later, I was in a refugee camp, and Sally had organized it. So the leaders of several refugee camps were there, and we started to talk. And after an hour or two, it became clear that what was bothering them could be summarized in a question. And the question was, how was it that we who call ourselves Christian ended up killing one another? Because approximately 80% of the Rwandais would have called themselves Christian. But they ended up killing one another. Women ended up killing children they had babysat. That's how bad it was. And they were deeply troubled when the whole episode was over and they were in refugee camps and a new government was in Kigali, which is just as bad as any government that's been there before. How did it happen? And then began what must be, I think, the most moving summer of my life, because I spent, on average, 3 to 6 hours a day teaching the refugee camps and the villages. They didn't allow me to teach medicine or science or nutrition. They didn't want that. They wanted me to talk about that question. And when I outlined the way I would approach it, they said, can they set up a program? And I thought it would be 2 or 3 lectures. And as I said, it was 3 to 6 hours every other day, including weekends, for 2 months. Deeply moving. Because what I talked about was 3 lectures, basically. Number one was, how do you understand the word salvation? Number two was, what do you mean by character? And number three is, what are the responsibilities of parents from a biblical perspective? Because that's what they wanted. In effect, I spent 2 months doing biblical theology with people who couldn't get enough. Would to God that you could imagine a situation in Canada where people would listen to 6 hours of teaching and then ask for more. Deeply moving. Do you see, they were in a situation which is not so far from ours. And I could start, in fact, with my own cultural history, which put them at ease in a way, because I began with 5th century Britain. In the 5th century, Britain was a place of horror, with continuous tribal warfare, worse than Rwanda. A man did not live beyond the age of 45, and a woman rarely made it to 40, because you would be killed in battle or murdered and raped afterwards. It was horrendous. And the great Pope Gregory heard about this brutal island and realized that as a Christian he had a responsibility to do something about it, and he sent the missionaries. They were terrified, but they obeyed. And God protected them, and Gregory had given them some very wise advice. He said, do not preach, live, for at least 6 months to a year before you start to preach. Let these tribal people see how you live together and then preach. When they did begin to preach, there was a massive turning to Christianity. And Britain was Christianized at the level of belief exceedingly quickly. But it was almost 100 years before there was any demographic evidence of improvement in the lot of women, the development of education, social organization. Conversion does not equal virtue. When you become a Christian, you become somebody who is under new ownership, who has new loyalties, but you have all the habits that you have grown up with. And they do not go away. They can be used, they can be modified, they do not have to dominate you as before, but they're still there. It takes time to create the virtues that are necessary for a society to survive. Those of you who are businessmen probably know this. If you have the choice between hiring the agnostic grandson of deeply committed grandparents and parents and the evangelically converted son of, what shall we say, gamblers and prostitutes, which one will you choose for a successful businessman? There's no question. It is the cultural history that determines the patterns of behavior, not the recent conversion history. The Jews knew this, which is why I ended up frequently in Deuteronomy 6. You see, which has become, for me as a paediatrician, the most important chapter in the Old Testament. It is the most important chapter to the Jews as well. It is the reason for their survival as a nation. You see, the Jews had an experience of God at Mount Sinai, the like of which no one here has had. And they all vowed that they would obey the laws of God. What did they do? They immediately trashed the first three. They made an idol, they worshipped it, and they broke their promises. There's the first three commandments gone. So Moses says in Deuteronomy, you couldn't keep the commandments. What use are they to you? If you could keep them, your society would be good, but you can't keep them. End of story? No. Moses goes on to say, but there is hope. And that's what Deuteronomy 6 is about. He says, you must love the Lord your God with all your heart, with all your strength, with all your might. Jesus adds in the New Testament, with all your mind. That was contained in heart in the Old Testament. But Jesus knowing about us at this stage, focusing on our feelings, put mind in, if we would but read carefully. And then he tells them how to do it. How many of you, is there anybody here who could tell me what comes after? What the next verse, it's Deuteronomy 6 verse 7 is, after loving the Lord your God with all your heart, with all your strength, and with all your might, what comes next? Sorry? Not in Deuteronomy 6, actually. It does in the... What? That's right. You must teach these things diligently to your children. Loving God is expressed in teaching diligently to your children. You must teach these things diligently to your children when you sit at a meal, when you rise up, and when you lie down, and when you go on a journey. And Moses, a little lower down, even makes it more explicit. He tells you how to do it. He says, when your son asks you the meaning of these things, you don't try and explain the meaning to children in abstract terms. No, he says, tell them the story. We were slaves in Egypt and God brought us out of bondage. You see, that is the end of barbarianism. It is the beginning of a cultural history which gives meaning to lives incorporated into the child's mind at an age when they're not even thinking about it. We are barbarians because we don't do that. And we will be neo-pagans within another 10 years unless there is a major turn back. How does it work? Well, it works, I think, like this. Children are not moral thinkers. They are mimics. They have minds like steel traps for stories and for what you do. They don't hear what you say in the same way as they hear what you do. But they do hear the stories. You all know that. And they approach stories differently as well. And you know that too. If you read a story to a little child, and then the next night you say, what story do I read? And they choose it. And you try and miss out a sentence. Well, they do. They tell you, you're not reading it right. You see, children want these stories because intuitively they want to get it right. They want to know what is going to make them who they're going to be. And we forget that. God put that wisdom there. That desire to get the story right. It's present in all cultures. In African village, it's usually a teenager who is the current custodian of the tribal story. And he can be called upon to tell the story. Everybody will sit around listening and making sure he doesn't make a mistake. We've forgotten those skills. I didn't realize. First time I was asked to preach in one African village, I preached on the Sermon on the Mount, and a year later I was back, and they said, will you preach again? I said, yes. But before I preached, the pastor reminded the congregation of what I had said a year before, and he was accurate. I said, that's incredible. He said, don't you think we talk about what you say? I said, I wish they did in Canada. They've forgotten it by the time they get to the narthex. But not so with the children. And by telling them the stories, you see what you're doing? You're putting two things into their mind. You're putting a story which will be the grist for the moral mill when they do become moral thinkers. And you're doing something else which is even more interesting in a way. You're putting metaphors into their minds. And we can't think about morality and what is right and what is wrong, what is good and what is evil, except in metaphors. Now, we are a nation possessed of debased metaphors. Just like the students misunderstood, weighed in the balances and found wanting, so we as a nation have forgotten our metaphors. I have, in fact, a test that I give to some Christian groups of metaphor recognition. It's 2 pages of biblical metaphors. People my age, blessed with my education, I went to school where every morning there was a hymn, a prayer, a chapter of the Bible, another hymn and another prayer. 20 minutes, every morning for 12 years. You learn a lot of scripture that way. I went to a church where the service lasted 2 hours and most of it was scripture. It just goes into children's minds. Go to Africa today. And they were in trouble because their services last 3 hours, but they're 90% music. Does that ring a bell too? It's content we lack. It's content that Paul was concerned about. It's content that Jesus was concerned about. You don't actually read of Jesus singing, ever. I'm sure he did, but you never read about it. We have to get the metaphors back, which means we have to put the stories into our children's hearts and minds. We don't even do it in church. You listen to the children's moment on Sunday morning and people try and teach them little morals. The little morals are for the adults, not for the children. They don't understand morals. They don't go home to help mummy because of the moral that was told them on Sunday morning. They go home to help mummy because she loves them. But you tell them the story and they'll take that in and they'll remember it. And they love the Bible stories. I have a little granddaughter who's just approaching 2. You know what the first story she really loved from the Bible was? The birth of Jesus. Now, I hadn't read the birth of Jesus with joy like that for years. As I suddenly saw that a little child could understand something I had forgotten. We do not read to our children. Do you know what the average contact time between parents and children is in Canada today? School-aged children and younger. It's less than 5 minutes of non-directive interaction. Who is the teacher in your home? The television. We were blessed that our family grew up in the developing world. We had no television. We didn't have a television in our house until the youngest was 15, when our next-door neighbor moved and couldn't get rid of the television and gave it to us. It wasn't switched on from the time I got back from Africa the year before last until October, 2 months. It can go 2 or 3 months without being switched on quite easily in our house. And what a blessing that was. We didn't know it. When we came to Canada, the church that we went to had a reading program to try and encourage the children to read. They stopped it the year after we arrived out of sheer embarrassment because my kids, with no television, were reading 10 times as many books as any other child in the church. It wasn't the children's, it wasn't differential intelligence, it was differential environments. It was the television that had killed their minds. It does terrible things. It diminishes attention span, it diminishes imagination, and it gives them no morals, no metaphors by which they can live. If I could, I would destroy every television in Canada and Canada would improve the next day and go on improving until they were. It was back to where it used to be. It is an utter disaster. So it takes courage to do that, though. Your husband will want his sports program. He'd be better off going to the bar to watch them and keeping the box out of the house. When I was growing up in a little church in Birmingham, one of the elders' children eventually persuaded him to buy a television. And it got as far as the front, you know, British homes have a garden gate and a front path. And they brought it in at the front gate, and as they opened it, the box was held up and he was standing there and it said, "This will bring the world into your home," and he sent it back. It's true. It brings the value systems of the world into our home. Now, we have to change that. That's what CRPP has to do in the long run. We didn't get to where we are overnight. This began more than 300 years ago. We're not going to get back overnight. What we're trying to do is not easy to market. Because in some ways we are only just beginning to understand ourselves how to approach this problem. It's not trendy to talk about principles, about the way education should function, about the way medicine law should function. But fortunately, thank God, there appears to be an awakening in this country that something has got to change. And the kinds of things we're saying are, in fact, resonating in people's minds. We are a group of professors in RYU are starting our own pre-university year in September 97 because we have become aware that the university has gone off course and we're going to go back on course and teach a traditional course for the year before university. They will learn Latin, the core of Western philosophy and Western literature as determined by us, not by them, the history of science and medicine and mathematics and some music, and there will be a great books program. Kids can't wait to start. Neither can their parents, because people know it has gone wrong. I started the new university year just a week or so ago, and in my fourth year science class, as usual, total ignorance about their cultural history. Grave sadness and disillusion. It is normal for students to say they did not enjoy their undergraduate program. It's wrong. Learning should be joyful, fascinating. And it is if you don't get sucked into the alternative utilitarian understanding. The heart of Christian learning is that God can be understood through his acts. That is why it's good to do. The worst possible thing, the worst possible word for education is one that Christians frequently use, the word relevance. Relevance is not a criterion for education. Truth is the criterion for education. I usually tell the students of a famous event that occurred in a university common room when Niels Bohr came into the common room one evening. And he looked very pleased with himself. And the professor of English said, Niels, you look very happy. What's happened today? He said, I had a good day. He said, well, what have you done? He said, well, I split the atom. And the English professor said, well, what praise the relevance of that? And Niels Bohr thought for a few minutes. He said, none whatsoever, fortunately, as far as I can see. You see, we don't know what is important. We're not in a position. Only God knows what's important. But we can determine what is true. And God will determine its importance in due course. And what CLPP exists for is to get back to the basic principles in all the main areas of public policy. You see, our current politicians rely on polls. So do university administrators and everybody else. Christians shouldn't rely on polls. They should rely on principles. We should decide what is good and what is right, and then work out how we persuade people that it is good and right. And in the process of that debate, we may find out that we are wrong, in which case we change. We've got to do that. And we've got to teach our kids how to argue the case. Now, I've said enough, and I will leave it to see what questions emerge. Thank you for your attention, and I hope that we've encouraged you to think about whether what I'm saying is true, whether you can help us to define the questions more clearly, and whether you can help us to achieve nothing less than the cultural renewal of Canada. It's an incredibly arrogant objective, isn't it? But it's necessary. Thank you.